Slides are available and copy of the slides are available for anybody who's interested. If you're like me and maybe a little technology challenged, feel free to email us for a, and we can email you a copy of the presentation or the handouts. So our topic today is delegated design. I'm assuming that most of the folks here are from the CSI Western New York area, but if not, welcome to everybody who tuned in from some other further afield place. Thanks for participating in the CSI Buffalo Western New York chapter activity. Hopefully with the COVID restrictions easing, this will hopefully be the last of our webinars. And again, we'll be starting to move on to in-person sessions starting in September, as our president, Devin, was just recently saying. Anyway, okay. And I'm having trouble advancing the slides. There we go. Okay, that's me. I'm an engineer working water and wastewater projects with over 30 years of experience. Despite that background of mine, hopefully this presentation is just as applicable for all the architects and the folks who work in vertical construction that are part of our presentation today. So our target audience, well, an awful lot, most of delegated design is really concerned structural engineers. So I put them at the top of our list, but really anybody who's a project manager or staff at a design professional consulting firm that either prepares construction documents or performs construction contract administration that in for projects that involve any delegated design, this presentation will be for you as well. So our learning objectives here, I'm not going to read all these aloud, but in short, we're going to talk a little bit about and try to understand what delegated design is, when it's used, what the architect or engineer's responsibilities are in properly delegating design and reviewing submittals for it, and where the requirements are going to be located in the construction documents. Near the end, we're going to talk briefly about some additional resources for some further learning. So unsurprisingly, our planned agenda, these are the sections that our presentation is divided into. Our agenda kind of follows our learning objectives. And without further ado, let's really get into the meat of our presentation today. So first, we're going to discuss using delegated design. Here, we're going to be going over a few of the basics of what delegated design is, what it is not, when it should be used, when it should not be used, and a few of the basics concerning delegated design. So we toss around these expressions, delegated design, what does it mean? Well, first off, I'm using the term delegated design. Some other folks out there might use other expressions such as design assistant. That's not necessarily a synonym for delegated design, at least in my book. Delegated design is, first off, it's expressly required by the construction contract documents, and it is when the final design of some specific element of the work hasn't been prepared by the architect or the engineer on the project, but rather is delegated through the construction contractor to a design professional who is hired either directly by the contractor or more often by a subcontractor or supplier of some tier. So again, they're preparing the final design of a specific element of the project as a whole. We're going to cover in the next couple of slides why that is done. Now, that's what the basics of what delegated design is. What is it not? Well, first off, any aspect of professional design of temporary construction or anything required for the contractor's means and methods of construction. So if you have a deep excavation that requires a complex system of excavation support and groundwater dewatering, all has to be designed by a professional engineer or a professional geologist. That's the contractor's means and methods. It's not part of the completed project as a functioning whole. So that is not delegated design. Also, another thing that's not delegated design, there's a few carve-outs or exceptions in common common in the industry that are not delegated design. I'm not entirely sure why, but they're not. One of the more obvious ones is that in many areas, the final design of certain types of structural connections might be done by an unlicensed person who's probably very experienced and has certain industry certifications, but they're not a professional engineer. And that is acceptable in to the architectural and engineering licensing boards. Another type of final design that's kind of delegated, but it's not delegated design by a professional engineer, is the final design of lightning protection systems, such as Faraday lightning rods around the perimeter of the top of a building. Those are done by a lightning protection specialist, either certified by the Lightning Protection Institute or by Underwriters Laboratories. So delegated design sometimes seems to be complicated. So a lot of people don't seem to understand it perhaps as well as they should, especially if they're practicing in it. I put a bullet here that says, whose design is it anyway? And that's because delegated design, it seems confusing to a lot of people because there's really two different design professionals who have their fingers in the final design. Each is sealing and signing part of it. Exactly what those different responsibilities are of the AE, who sealed and signed the project's overall drawings and specs, and the delegated design professional, as I'm calling it in this presentation, the delegated designer, that's also typically a professional engineer, and what the delegated designer's responsibilities are and how they differ, the AEs, we'll be talking about that. But we want to make sure that if you're the AE on the project, you're trying to maintain clear, bright lines of professional responsibility and professional liability here, because again, two different entities that do not typically have a contractual relationship with each other are each sharing some responsibility for certain parts of the project. So it's easy for that to be a little unclear. Most of us prefer this kind of thing to be real clear and easy to follow. And this, there is a line between the respective responsibilities, but it's not as easy to discern at times. Now, over the years, I've seen a number of engineers or architects who try to escape their responsibility for delegated designs, whether because they lack a complete understanding of what the responsibilities are, or they try to slough it off contractually, or for some other reason or some other way. You're probably not escaping your responsibilities and your professional liability, even if you're expressly trying to escape it. It's there for you. You have a responsibility by licensure, probably by contract, and it's no sense trying to get away from delegated design when you're requiring it and to say it's all the responsibility of the delegated designer. If you're the AE on the project, you've got some responsibility here, and you can't undertake delegated design lightly because a lot of professional judgment is needed to do this properly and to keep yourself and your client and the project and the public out of trouble. So delegated design is appropriate when, first off, obviously it needs to be allowed or at least not disallowed by laws and regulations governing the practice of the subject design professions. I'm not aware of any state that disallows this. One of the states where I'm licensed is Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania doesn't seem to address delegated design at all in its regulations, but nonetheless, delegated design is alive and well in Pennsylvania. So it's probably okay in every state, but I just want to say for those who might practice in other states, you want to check first before you start engaging in delegated design. So why do we do delegated design? Multiple suppliers or subcontractors can furnish appropriate products, but each has slightly different design aspects or features that how they connect to the rest of the building or facility, how they're fabricated, and so forth. Sometimes special design expertise for these types of systems is needed that ordinary design professional consultants do not typically possess, probably because there's certain kinds of expertise needed in how that item is produced at its production facility. But regardless of all this, the AE delegating the design needs to have a sufficient understanding of that thing or system in order to properly prepare the design for effective and appropriate design delegation. In other words, if you don't understand anything at all about the delegated design system, you're probably not the right person to be delegating the design of it. And I also tried to say, don't come up with delegating design when its use of delegated design is not customary. And we'll have a slide coming up of the types of work that are customarily delegated design. Now, I have a final slide on this because some of the folks who reviewed this presentation for me and worked with me on the development of it said, well, once in a while, you can do some delegated design to try to save some time. I'm not sure exactly how that really happens because the final design needs to be done either by the AE or by the delegated designer. I'm not sure how this saves time other than maybe possibly shortening up some of the design phase, the AE's design phase, but at the expense of adding time into the construction phase. So whether delegated design can save any time on your overall project is might depend on the project itself. So let's flip this around. Delegated design is not appropriate. So don't go down the delegated design road when any of these things apply. First off, when the AE is saying, I don't feel like having the design responsibility for that thing, I'm going to shed some of my professional liability. Well, that's not an appropriate reason for a delegated design. Believe me, I've seen plenty of design professionals that are doing delegated design for all of the reasons on here, but this, at least in my view, is not a proper reason for it. Sometimes an AE says, let's do that delegated design because we've got a low budget or we're out of budget. I don't have sufficient time to complete the rest of the design. We'll just toss that design responsibility on the contractor. That's also not a good reason for doing delegated design. If you don't have the necessary experience or expertise for services that you're included in your scope of services, that's not a good reason to do it either. If that's the case, go hire a sub-consultant who does possess the necessary expertise. And if you're engaging in public work, a question has arisen. I've seen one or two examples of this in the past of where a public owner or their design consultant decided to try to delegate a very, very large proportion of the design of the project, maybe where such delegation wasn't customary. Probably because of time or budgetary reasons and what their design professional fee budget was had available. And so in those cases, it certainly occurs to me that delegating too much in the public arena where design delegation is not customary could be design build. And at least here in New York, in our nearby state, Pennsylvania, design build is not enabled for most public entities. So before you try to delegate too much, think, am I turning this into a design build project when it's public work? So common types of work that are delegated design, I'm certainly not going to read these all aloud. So listen to me as well as read the slide on your own. If you say, I'd really love a copy of this, well, I borrowed most of this list from a New York State Office of the Professions Architecture Guidelines document, for which I'll have some information in our resources at the end of this presentation. But anyway, you can see that a lot of the types of things that are normally delegated design, and we have a second slide with more on it, so this is not all. A lot of things that are either prefabricated, pre-engineered structural systems or prefabricated, pre-engineered structures that are produced in a factory somewhere and brought on a truck to the site to be installed into the project. Now, they're not all quite exactly like that, but to some extent or another, these all sort of fall kind of into that category. Curtain walls are not produced remotely, but might be very specific to a certain kind of manufacturer. Window washing systems for building facades, you know. And our second slide here, bleachers, certainly domed structures, cable supported structures, pre-engineered metal structures, metal buildings, mezzanines, these are all sort of structural type systems produced in a factory. elevators, escalators, moving walkways, among other things. Some of their structural components are really delegated design. Turntables, funiculars, had to put in a thing for my own industry here, as engineer-led utility construction, utility storage tanks, whether it's elevated or ground-level water storage tanks, fuel tanks, or tanks that store industrial liquids, those are typically delegated design as well, whether they're steel, precast concrete, or something else. So there's a lot of different kinds of things that are normally delegated professional design, and there we go. Another thing that can be a point of embarrassment on some projects is if the architect or engineer plans to delegate the design of some aspect of the work, but the owner isn't aware of something called delegated design, and you get to the point where you're under construction, and the engineer or the architect says, Well, that's part of the contractor's design responsibility. That might come as real and perhaps unpleasant news to the owner when they say, didn't I hire you and pay you to do the design? Why are you foisting part of the design off on the contractor? So during your project's design phase, it's a good idea for all the consultants out there to make the owner aware of what aspects of the project are going to be delegated design. The owner might want to know why these things should be delegated design. I think it's probably a very good idea to put this right into your scope of architecture and engineering services and your agreements with your clients. That way, if for some reason something changes during design and they say, no, we're not going to allow that to be delegated design, then at least you might have a route to get an amendment for additional compensation or additional time. But remember, if the owner for some reason digs in their heels and say, I'm not allowing this, I've never heard of this delegated design, I'm just not comfortable with it, you're not allowed to do it. My advice is to not let yourself to be pushed into some type of design work that you and your team are not experienced or qualified to perform properly. Remember, it's your professional liability insurance and your architecture or engineering license, not the owner. But sometimes managing those owner expectations can be a challenge, and you want to make sure your owner is aware of delegated design, why, what project components, and that they're on board with the decision. A few thoughts about budget, and then we'll have another slide on time. Your professional services budget probably needs to be, whoever prepares that budget should be aware of that parts of the project will be delegated design. Your construction phase services budget will probably need to have a little bit of extra time in it because, at least in my experience, when you've got delegated design of something like a pre-engineered metal building, there's usually more time for the design professional in there to perform some of the necessary coordination than there might be if they had designed it all themselves. Again, a little extra construction phase budget might be necessary. How much depends upon you, your team, what part of the work's delegated design, and so forth. Also, when you're preparing construction cost estimates, you might want to also consider that there is a cost to do the delegated design. Now, some types of construction, such as pre-engineered metal buildings, when you get a price quote from a pre-engineered metal building supplier during your design phase, it probably already includes the delegated design effort. But for some other types of delegated design, a third-party design professional might need to be hired by the subcontractor or supplier. And you might want to make sure that that design effort is included in your construction budget. Now, timing, a few considerations here about how delegated design affects the contract times. The current edition and recent editions of the Model International Building Code do recognize the concept of delegated design, so it should be acceptable to building code officials, but most of us can probably tell a few stories that they've encountered a building code official here or there that has their own interpretation on the code, or if they're not personally familiar with delegated design, I'm not accepting that are issuing a building permit until all aspects of the project's final design are in my hands and I can review it all together. you probably, if you've got delegated design to some significant aspect of your project and a building permit is necessary, you want to probably check with the building code official to determine their familiarity with delegated design, how they'd handle it, and factor that into your project's timetable. Also, when you're stipulating the construction contract times during design, somebody's preparing that owner contractor agreement before the project is the contractor is hired. The construction contract times need to consider that some aspect of the project's final design is being done during the construction phase, and to make sure if that's on the project's critical path, that there's sufficient time allowed in that preliminary design phase schedule of construction so that the contract times are appropriate. This is a presentation here for the CSI Buffalo Western New York chapter, so focusing a little bit here on New York State requirements. There's one set of requirements governing both architecture and engineering here in New York State that says how delegated design is okay and provides a few basic requirements governing delegated design practice in New York. Now, as far as I've seen, I can't claim to have read the laws and regs of all 50 states, but New York is one of the states that has its act most together relative to clarifying responsibilities and obligations for delegated design. I mentioned earlier in the presentation, next door, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania doesn't mention delegated design in any way in its architecture or engineering laws and regulations. So you can see here, delegated design is okay, but the person doing the delegated design needs to be appropriately licensed themselves as an architecture or engineer, as the case may be. That performance and design criteria the delegated design must satisfy must be indicated in writing. The architect or engineer who sealed and signed the project documents in the first place needs to approve that delegated design once it's prepared. We'll talk about that approval process in more detail. So we've got the chapter and verse up here in New York regulations. Check that out if you do delegated design. If you're licensed and practicing in New York, you should know this stuff. Okay, let's talk a little bit about how to require delegated design in a set of construction contract documents. Well, this is a summary slide here. It's the delegated design requirements are kind of spread around a bit. First off, drawings are going to indicate something about the delegated design. For some reason, when my poster child of delegated design examples is pre-engineered metal buildings, and while that the final design of that pre-engineered metal building is done by the delegated designer, the drawings prepared by the architect or the engineer show the layout of that building, the arrangement of the rooms, how many doors, their size, their location, windows, where main structural elements might be, column lines, for example. All that is part of the performance and design criteria the delegated design needs to satisfy, and that's shown on the drawings. The project's general conditions typically have some very important and basic aspects of risk allocations for delegated designs. In the upcoming slides, we're going to take a closer look at what both AIA 8201 and the EJCDC standard general conditions say about that. Your construction contract should have requirements for professional liability insurance applicable to the contractor's team. If you're working with AIA documents, the model language of the A101 owner contractor agreement, the insurance exhibit, includes language for professional liability insurance requirements. Similar kinds of requirements are included in EJCDC C800's language on contractor furnished insurance, including professional liability. But if you're using something other than AIA or EJCDC documents and your project has delegated design, you want to make sure that there are professional liability insurance requirements applicable to the contractor. We will talk in this presentation a little bit about a specification section 013573, delegated design procedures. This was added to CSI master format, maybe 5 years or so ago. I wrote a section on this for my employer's master spec system, But I haven't seen too many other folks, one or two other examples from other firms, but not too many. So use of this kind of spec section might be a little unfamiliar to some people. Now, a section 017123 field engineering that, quite frankly, has nothing to do with delegated design, but it sort of tap dances close to it. So I'm going to have a slide where we'll address that. And of course, the division 2 through 49 specs, where the delegated design work is required, are really where the rubber meets the road in establishing that performance and design criteria the delegated design must satisfy. So we'll talk about what to put in those sections as well. Well, I'm an engineer, so I put the EJCDC slide first. First off, under paragraph 701, which is regarding the contractor's means and methods, EJCDC specifically says that any kind of design professional services that relate to the contractor's means and methods or temporary construction is specifically not delegated design. EJCDC C700 7.19 is called delegation of professional design services, and that's the real provisions on delegated design. It says the contractor is not responsible for performing professional services unless expressly required by the contract, and the construction documents for delegated design are going to expressly indicate the performance and design criteria the delegated design must satisfy, and the contractor is not responsible for the adequacy of that performance and design criteria. So when some people say, well, the contractor's delegated designer is responsible for the delegated design. Well, as I said earlier, two different design professionals got their fingers in this. The AE is the one establishing the performance and design criteria the delegated design must satisfy. You are sealing and signing that aspect of the construction documents. So you're both in this. Some more of the EJCDC general conditions. Professional standard of care applies. The contractor has to be licensed in accordance with a defined term called laws and regulations. And the owner and the engineer have the right to rely upon the contractor's delegated design, and the engineer is to review and approve the delegated design submittals for certain limited purposes. And we'll go over in some detail in this presentation what those are. Now, the language of AIA 8201 is pretty similar to that of EJCDC C700. In fact, before the most recent edition of the EJCDC general conditions, they were literally identical, except for the word architect was used in one and the word engineer used in the other. A201 does not include the term delegated design. You won't find those words in there if you're doing a word search in A201. And its delegated design provision is section 312.10. This is actually under the contractor's submittal requirements, but 312.10 is the provisions in A201 that address delegated design. And you can see on here, it's very, very similar requirements to those of EJCDC. So to save time, I'm not going to read them out loud. Here, AIA calls the delegated designer the professional. Their seal and signature is to appear on the delegated design professional's submittals, or if there's delegated design submittals that weren't prepared under that delegated designer's supervision and control, a express delegated designer approval stamp has to appear. One thing that's a little different is that AIA does not address the standard of care. However, probably the statutory standard of care would apply unless to the delegated designer, unless there was some perhaps higher standard of care established by some way in the construction documents or that professional services agreement between the delegated designer and the entity that hired them, contractor, subcontractor, or supplier. All the rest of this stuff's pretty similar to the EJCDC provision. One slight advantage AIA has over the engineers is that the owner-architect professional services agreement, B101, has some language in it that about delegated design that coordinates with what's in A201, whereas what's in the owner-engineer agreement of EJCDC is currently a pretty oblique and hard to decipher reference to delegated design. It really doesn't use the term delegated design in the engineering agreement. So if you're using some other form of general conditions, perhaps unique to a client, I've seen very few client-specific general conditions in a construction contract that address delegated design. And therefore, if you're using such general conditions, this section 013573 starts to take on greater importance. If you use this section, obviously it needs to be closely coordinated with the general conditions, especially if they're A201 or C700. You do not want to repeat or conflict with what's in the general conditions. Now, the lower half of this slide here includes a list of the types of topics that, well, that I've included in my firm's section 013573. The first one here, general provisions for delegated design, that's a pretty plain vanilla statement there. But what I did in my firm's section was added a user note that says, if you're using something other than our standard general conditions, which fully address delegated design, take out this vanilla paragraph that says delegated design shall be in accordance with the general conditions and replace it with language copied out of the, well, in our case, EJCDC general conditions and put it in this Division 1 section. You want to make sure you get that basic allocations of risks and responsibilities that are the benchmark as established in the AIA or EJCDC general conditions. You want to make sure that's in your project someplace, especially if your owner-specific construction general conditions do not already address delegated design. So some of the other things that are on this list of stuff that's in my firm's section 013573, we'll talk about in a little more detail in some of the upcoming slides here. Bear in mind here about we're going to talk about delegated design submittals as the final main section of this presentation. So they're not in the next couple of upcoming slides. So coordination requirements. I've assisted a number of project teams in trying to resolve construction claims that arose due to delegated designs because the contractor's delegated design required some change in the architect or engineer prepared aspects of the design to which the delegated design connected. Again, using pre-engineered metal buildings as my poster child for delegated designs, more than once I've encountered the situation where the delegated designer, who's usually an employee of the pre-engineered metal building fabricator, did something different with how the structure would connect to the foundation designed by the project structural engineer. And then afterwards, somebody expected the owner to pay a change order because some changes in the foundation design were necessary because of the delegated design. In my firm's section 013573, we have language that says that the delegated design must coordinate with what's shown on the drawings and required in the specifications. If the contractor is proposing a delegated design that has something that affects the architect or engineer prepared design of some other part of the project, that's going to be a substitute in the contract. Substitution procedures apply. Our section also says that the contractor is responsible for the costs incurred by the owner in any redesign necessary for approval of a substitute via the delegated design. And you can see some of the rest of the slide. So coordination of the delegated design with other aspects, whether prepared by the architect or engineer or existing construction, very important and a frequent source of claims or disagreements where delegated design is required. So this is a place to try to put some boundaries around that. Other stuff that would be in the section 013573, you might want to expressly establish the standard of care applicable to delegated design work. Again, the A201 general conditions do not expressly do that. You might also include some basic qualifications requirements for the design professional, the delegated designer. However, the general conditions already say they have to be properly licensed. So how many more qualifications requirements you need to impose, I'm not sure. If you start stipulating it too detailed of a fashion, well, you might be starting to put your fingers more into that delegated design more than you intended. Finally, our section 013573 includes a list of mandatory responsibilities of the delegated designer. It turns out to be a fairly substantial list, not unlike what the architect or engineer scope of services might be in its own agreement with the owner. I'm not going to try to mandate to you what that should be in a construction contract, but suffice to say that the delegated designer does more than just prepare a couple of drawings and a set of calcs and send it in, or at least they should be. Now, I mentioned previously there's this section 017123, field engineering. Well, this has nothing to do with delegated design, but it may be addressing design professional services prepared performed by or for the contractor that are not delegated design. So in my firm's 017123, among many other things addressed in the spec section, I've included some very broad language which says where the contractor is performing professional services for its means and methods, that design professional shall be properly licensed, properly insured, and that the owner and the engineer have a right to rely upon the adequacy and completeness of the design professional services performed by the contract, by or for the contractor, for its means and methods and for temporary construction. So again, not delegated design, but sometimes some people get a little confused about what is and is not delegated design. So I thought I would mention this slide or this section. Very important here, how do we specify delegated design in divisions 2 through 49 in the spec section that requires the delegated design? Well, first off, you want to be very clear on what is the extent of the delegated design. Certainly, you're going to show that on the drawings, but what specific part of the work is going to be delegated design should be indicated very clearly in the spec section. I'm kind of a fan of right at the very beginning of the spec section, paragraph 1.1a, the section includes statement. It's usually a good idea, I think, to alert the contractor. This includes delegated design in this section. If you've got a section 013573, I'm not normally a fan of cross-referencing or citing Division 1 spec sections in the Division 2 through 49 specs, but in the case of 013573 delegated design procedures, I make an exception. Since most people aren't used to that spec section in Division 1, I'd like to say that that section applies, put it in the related requirements section of the spec requiring the delegated design in 2 through 49. If you got some coordination requirements that go above and beyond what might be in 013573, you'd put them in the administrative requirements section of your Division 2 through 49 spec. In the quality assurance article, you might perhaps require a pre-design meeting with the delegated designer. You might augment or modify the qualifications requirements for the delegated designer. And you also need to indicate which submittals, delegated design submittals are going to be required. And that's a very essential aspect because it's what parts of the delegated design are going to be furnished to you, the AE, to review. Now, in part two products, CSI section format has allocates a provision called performance and design criteria. When you've got a delegated design, I think it's critical that you have in the associated division 2 through 49 spec section on the delegated design work that you have a provision in there called performance and design criteria. One of my firm specs that required delegated design previously had in it performance and design requirements, but they were really scattered all over the place and it wasn't really too clear exactly what was the performance and design criteria and maybe what wasn't intended as performance and design criteria. This is the requirements for the delegated design that you're sort of flowing down, if you will, even though you don't have a subcontract. that is the responsibility of the delegated designer. So I think it's really essential that that spec section have provision expressly titled performance and design criteria. And you put in there what is the necessary performance and design criteria. Some people may want to tend to over-specify. The more you tie the delegated designer's hands, the fewer benefits you're going to get from delegated design. My firm has a spec section where we put at a central location all of the seismic and wind load requirements applicable to the entire project. If you have something like that yourself, we have it in 0181 something. You want to expressly cite that in your performance and design criteria requirements. Use your professional judgment in how much performance and design criteria you need to stipulate. But remember, as the AE in responsible charge of the overall project, this delegated, you're responsible for how this delegated design fits in with the rest of the project you designed. So you also probably can't say, delegated designer, do whatever you want, because it needs to be coordinated with and fit in with and be appropriate for your design intent for the overall project as a functioning whole. Now, our final main section of the presentation here, we're going to talk about somewhat about delegated design submittals. Now, this is a tricky thing because we can specify the delegated design properly, but I think where a lot of the potential liability really comes into the picture is, and where people get confused, is what do they do with submittals of delegated designs? I've seen a widespread and pretty stubbornly held opinion among many engineers that I've worked with that when they have a delegated design, they say, I don't want to see any of the submittals for it at all, or we'll require the submittals, but we're not going to review them. We just put them in the file. Neither one of those is appropriate. It's probably not consistent with your obligations under your professional services contract. And the processing delegated design submittals can be tricky because normally when you get a regular shop drawing, well, you say, well, I'm responsible for the design of this thing and I need to review the whole shop drawing or all the product data and to look at it pretty thoroughly and give it a affirmative thumbs up approval or a rejection or whatever actions it is you like to call it. But when it comes to delegated design submittals, this is a little tricky. The architect or engineer performs a limited view. You're reviewing it partway. What is the extent to which you're supposed to review it? Well, we'll try to address that here. But that's where delegated design submittals and their review by the design professional gets a little tricky. So let's briefly just talk a little bit about the concept of submittals furnished by the contractor in the first place. It's both AIA and EJCDC agree that the contractor furnishes submittals to the architect or engineer for the architect or engineer to review, to determine, to attempt to determine that the submittal demonstrates compliance with the contract document's requirements, which is enforceable under the construction contract, and that the delegated design, or the not just the delegated design, that whatever is shown in that submittal is consistent with the architect or engineer's design intent for the completed project as a functioning whole. Now, as I like to say, you can't necessarily enforce your design intent if your contract documents haven't clearly communicated it, but really, in an ordinary submittal, this is your last chance to get it right. Now, delegated design submittals, they're like any other submittal in that respect, but there might be some heightened opportunities to share the contractor's or delegated design professional's liability here. So the AE reviews shop drawings or submittals of any sort for the reasons we were just talking about. And if you aren't sure what I just said, well, look it up in your own professional services contract. I got the citations here to the AIA and EJCDC professional services agreements. Both of them say that the architect or engineer reviews submittals for certain reasons. It doesn't make any differentiation between if it's an action submittal or if it's an informational submittal. I don't have to review it. It says you review and take appropriate action on contractor furnished submittals that are required by the contract documents. So if the contract documents have required it, just receiving it and saying I'm putting it in my file, you might be courting some risk with that. If you receive that submittal, you're supposed to review it. If you never intend to review it, don't require it. Because, you know, put yourself in the situation of having to answer a hostile attorney's question when you're under oath. Are you in the habit of requiring shop drawings that you never intend to review? Why would you require those? If you required it, weren't you supposed to review it under your professional standard of care and your professional services agreement? The answer is, well, yeah, I was supposed to review it. So if anybody out there who thinks because it's a delegated design submittal, I don't have to review it, you are not correct in that assumption. So anybody who's familiar with CSI section format knows that CSI divides submittals into four types: action submittals, informational submittals, closeout submittals, and maintenance material submittals. Where do delegated design submittals fall under this? Well, an awful lot of them are action submittals that require an express approval by the architect or engineer, at least approval if you're using AIA or EJCDC standard general conditions. Types of delegated design submittals that are going to be what I personally call the delegated design instruments of service submittals. I looked for an alternative term, but instruments of service seems to be the most widely used term that's appropriate here. This is the contractor's delegated designer's design drawings, design specifications if they prepare those, evaluation reports, and also their calculations. Now, at my firm, we've decided that calculations should be an informational submittal, and we have to review the performance that the delegated design has satisfied the performance and design criteria indicated in the contract document. So we've required this separate certification of compliance that's going to expressly indicate what performance and design criteria. That's how we've done it here at HDR Engineering. Others are probably just receiving a copy of the delegated designer's calculations. And when you do that, those calculations are most likely going to be a delegated design action submittal, or as I call them, instruments of service submittals. What are informational submittals? Well, here in my company, since we have the certificate of compliance as an action submittal, the actual detailed calculations are an informational submittal. Any shop drawings that are reviewed and approved by the delegated designer are, to us, informational submittals. Why? Because they already bear the delegated designer's own approval stamp. There's no reason for us to put our approval stamp on it. However, sometimes the delegated designer's design drawings and shop drawings are combined into a single submittal. How do you know when that happens? Well, if it has the delegated designer's professional engineering seal and signature on it, then it's a combined one, and that means it's design drawings, even if it is also shop drawings, and it needs to be treated as an action submittal. Some other kinds of informational submittals in the delegated design realm: the delegated designer's qualification statement, and there might be some others like copies of their written reports of their visits to the site during construction, perhaps. We'll discuss how those are treated in some upcoming slides. So let's talk a little bit here about reviewing the delegated designer's instruments of service submittals. According to both the EJCDC and the AIA standard general conditions, the AE is required to, give those an approval or some other kind of appropriate action. But what are we looking to verify here? Well, to verify that the delegated design requirements of the construction contract were complied with, that, for example, the delegated design was sealed and signed by a professional engineer who's got a proper, valid, current license and registration in the same state as the project site, as just one example. And you're going to be reviewing it to verify that that delegated design appears reasonably complete. Now, by that, I don't mean that you crawl into all the details of it, but we've all probably seen some submittal you could just tell by how many sheets were in the set of submittal drawings. Well, this isn't the whole thing. So is it missing some major element or not? And finally, and most importantly, does that delegated design, is it consistent with the performance and design criteria required in the construction documents? Now, remember, I said we've got a limited review, and I've just said we're not going into all the weeds here. So for different kinds of submittals, what are some of the things you look at and don't look at? Well, when it comes to delegated design drawings, for example, specs, maybe other instruments of service, some of the things that we're planning to do here, this is what you should be doing. Verify that it's properly sealed and signed. Verify, well, you've seen all this and you guys can read this. There's no need for me to read it aloud. But you want to mostly verify that delegated design submittal reflects the performance and design criteria required in the contract documents, and it's consistent with your design intent for the completed project as a functioning whole. I tend to say that it's a good idea to have an AE submittal approval stamp that is specific to the unique needs of delegated design instruments of service submittals. What should the specific language of that be? We're not going to cover that in these slides, but I do have a recent post on my blog on CSI's website, csiresources.org, which has suggested language for an AE's submittal review stamp for action submittals, instruments of service submittals. Now, when we're talking about when we're talking about calculations, why are we obtaining those in the first place? Well, other than verifying that they're satisfying the performance and design criteria required in the construction contract documents, we're mostly obtaining them for the owner's records and perhaps for the benefit of the building code official and for obtaining the building permit. So bear in mind why these calculations are being furnished. You're looking at them when you're reviewing them. It's only for a limited purpose. And some of the kinds of things you're reviewing, well, we already looked at that. We're trying to verify that they satisfy the performance and design criteria indicated in the contract documents. Some of the kinds of things you don't want to review with contractor furnished calculations for delegated designs is the delegated designer's assumptions, at least if the contract documents haven't said what those assumptions should be. You don't want to check their computational method, math errors, all these things of going into the weeds. Some of you who might be project managers might have some experience with a structural engineer who insists on wanting to go through every aspect of delegated design calculations. It might be a little hard to steer some of them away from that. But again, the more you go into the weeds and comment that I found a math error here, and look, your assumptions are based on the wrong edition of the building code there, the more you comment on that, the more you might inadvertently and unintentionally be starting to take some professional responsibility for that delegated design. The contractor's delegated designer's lawyer in a lawsuit is likely to be contending, they commented on all this other stuff. My client started to rely upon them looking at this kind of thing. Arbitrators, judges, juries are often find such arguments compelling. So hence the reason for the limited review. And really no place except in reviewing delegated design calculations does this become more tempting for your project structural engineer to go into the weeds, and you want to try to discourage them from doing so. We'll talk a little bit more about what happens when you become aware that, gee, there is something that is seriously wrong here. Even though I wasn't supposed to look at it, I found it anyway. And what do I do? I can't keep silent. We'll address that. Okay. Reviewing delegated design shop drawings. Now, these are shop drawings that don't bear, it's shop drawings for the delegated design, but they don't bear the delegated designer's professional engineering seal. What do you do with those? I tend to recommend that these should be classified, as far as the AE is concerned, as informational submittals, that if they're acceptable, they don't require a written response from the AE. You don't want to put your shop drawing approval stamp on it alongside that of the delegated designer, because if you do that and there's something wrong with that shop drawing, chances are a licensing board or a judge or jury is likely to say both their approval stamps were on it side by side. They share the responsibility for it equally, 50% liability to each one. So you want to let the delegated designer who designed that approve that shop drawing on their own, and you're receiving that shop drawing only as an informational submittal. Why? What limited purposes are we checking this for? To verify that it was received. We're getting this mostly for the owner's records and for the benefits of the building code official. Remember, the owner wants to have a complete record of the shop drawings of what went into its facility. And you probably want to check this to make sure that it generally appears reasonably complete, not to dive into the details, but again, if you only got one shop drawing sheet and you were expecting about half a dozen, you can say maybe something's missing here, and you want to verify that it bears the delegated designer's approval stamp. Not much more than that. Again, a very limited review. And you need to understand that you're looking at it only for limited purposes. The delegated designer has the professional liability for approving the shop drawing. Now, if that informational submittal of that delegated designer approved shop drawing is not acceptable, there's something in it you've noticed that's wrong. What do you do? Well, now you do have to give them a written comment back. I tend to recommend, unfortunately, another specific type of architect or engineer's review stamp for this type of submittal that has its own specific disclaimer language on it that points out the engineer's or architect's comments on that delegated design submittal. Okay, well, what happens when you take the calculations, you dropped the printout of them on the floor, they went all over the place, and when the process of picking up the sheets, you accidentally noticed that something in it was wrong. They had a complete math error that just now the delegated design is not going to be consistent with good structural engineering practice. The public health, safety, welfare might be impacted. It could compromise the physical integrity of the project. In this case, you're bound by the ethics of your own professional licensure to speak up. You notice something wrong, you can't just stay quiet when you're convinced there is a real problem here. When you do this, this is a real tricky thing. Now you're coloring outside the lines of the scope of your limited review, and you're trying to avoid putting your fingers in the ringer. Again, my recent blog post on csiresources.org, titled Delegated Design Submittals, has some suggested language for what to do when the architect or engineer feels it's really essential to make a comment outside the areas of the limits of the review because they think that the public health, safety, welfare could be impacted. My disclaimer language includes words such as, we did not review every aspect of this. You can't count on our review. We just noticed this that we think is the case. You have full responsibility and liability for this. That's the kinds of things in the disclaimer language that I recommend. Again, we're trying to maintain a clear, bright line of professional liability here. Other types of delegated design submittals, Well, you could have the delegated designer's qualifications. Usually this needs to be only a copy of their license and registration in the same state as the site, but maybe sometimes somebody wants to require more than that and you need to verify that they do indeed comply. If there's any kind of shop testing requirements or field testing requirements for the delegated design work, those should probably be reviewed and approved by the delegated designer rather than by the project's AE. The delegated design professional, when they visit the site during construction, now sometimes they might not visit the site during construction if it's just a kind of a more rinky-dink kind of delegated design. But for something like a 10-story tall glass curtain wall, probably the delegated designer might need to visit the construction site once or twice or more during the course of construction. And in your section 013573, you might want to require, I want a copy of your written report of each visit to the site. And what do you review for that? You review that it was signed by that delegated designer and that it was properly dated. But you don't have to comment any more than that. But that report might also alert you to some problems that needed to be fixed by that delegated designer when they visited the site. Okay, submittals not required and not desired. We just don't want to go here, except we don't want to require these, accept them, keep them in our file for any reason at all. Professional design performed by or for the contractor for means and methods or temporary construction. Let's just not go there. That's there in that separate design professional's responsibility. This isn't delegated design. You see some examples listed on this slide of what these types of things might be. Now, being an engineer in horizontal construction, there's been enough times on a project where we've had a 25-foot deep hole open in the middle of Main Street and the 48-inch diameter, 100-year-old creaky water main that carries all the water to the left half of the city is suspended 25 feet in the air above this open hole. The owner says, that's such a rickety old pipeline. I want the contractor to provide the temporary supports, but I want you as the engineer to review them and approve them. Well, that's a temporary construction. You don't normally want to get anything on that. If the support of that, the temporary supports for that item are so critical, then the owner and the design professional, the AE, might as well just stipulate what the required design is for it and treat it like it was part of the completed project, even though it's only temporary construction. Otherwise, except in those very rare special cases, you don't want to get any means and methods or temporary construction type designs. Okay, we're in the home stretch here. Just a few final slides. Some resources. Well, the laws and regulations in effect where you are licensed. In the standard contract documents, your professional services contract in particular. The New York State Office of the Professions under the New York State Education Department has three very good online, anybody can access them whether you live in New York or not, guideline documents for delegated design. I've listed them on here. There's one for engineering. The Architecture Board has two. So the architects, you know, kind of win this one. Their guidance is even more complete and appropriate than the engineers. But I've directed lots of people to these documents, these New York State documents over the years, regardless of whether they were licensed in New York or not, because they're some of the finest guidance I've seen anywhere on delegated design. And it represents, in my mind, good practice, regardless of whether you're licensed in New York or not. If you Google delegated design, you can find all kinds of white papers online. Their usefulness and applicability varies quite a bit. Some of the ones by the AIA are okay. There's a lot of ones out there by the Associated General Contractors of America, and those are mostly regarding how contractors can try to escape their delegated design obligations. So when you aren't sure of the source, take it for what it's worth. Now, I've got a couple of things I've written on delegated designs. One is a two-part article called Passing the Design Ball that is my attempt to have addressed delegated design about as well as I can. Originally published in the newsletter of CSI's Buffalo Western New York chapter in January and February of 2019. over the last couple of years, some versions of this have gotten out into other chapters. I tried Googling it early this week, and you can actually find it online posted by other chapters. Anybody who wants a copy of this, if it's not already in the handouts that you can download from this presentation today, feel free to email me, and I'm happy to share a copy of that article with you. Also posted just in recent weeks, this month, June 2021, on my blog on CSI's website is an article called Shop Drawings and Submittals, Delegated Design Submittals. This is what has a lot of this suggested language for some of these disclaimer stamps and stuff that I've been talking about, as well as other practices regarding dealing with delegated design submittals. So that's the end here. We've talked about all these things that were part of our initial learning objectives, and without reading this out loud, if we have some time, Devin, we can take some questions either orally or typed into the chat, or if anyone has questions or comments after the session, my contact info is on the slide. Always happy to hear from people that might have taken the time to listen to a webinar of mine. So,
I haven't gotten any questions through the chat, but if people want to, we do have a large group. So, you know, if we do have any questions, let's try to unmute yourself and go ahead and ask.
This is Jack Giljohn. We're in Columbus, Ohio. Great presentation. Thank you. We've been reading your blog, and it's just excellent. My question here, I think, is half a question. We often use or see delegated design for what I will say are not prefabricated stairs. You know, standard channels, stairs, and railings. And we often say, you know, the railings and stairs are required to be designed by the miscellaneous metals subcontractor. Do you have any comment about that being delegated design or?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I can probably give you half an answer. Both my current firm and my prior employer use delegated design for handrails and railings, probably because there's so many different ways in which they can be fabricated, reinforced, attached, and so forth. But how that all relates to stairs, I'm a little less familiar since I'm not a structural engineer or an architect myself. I certainly understand and appreciate why pre-engineered or prefabricated stair systems are typically delegated design, but I'm not sure what the rationale would be for having something that wasn't being made in a factory to be delegated design, unless it might be just for the handrails or railings along it, perhaps. So it's unfortunately about the best advice or response I could provide on that question.
Thanks. That's helpful. I've always been thinking that they shouldn't be delegated because we draw the size, we draw the spacing, we draw everything about them. What the dickens are we delegating?
Right. Yeah. If the contractor is doing building the thing based on your prescriptive design, it again, as I said earlier, if your performance and design criteria, the delegated design must satisfy, are so detailed that there isn't much leeway in what the delegated designer can do, what's the point of doing delegated design?
Kevin, we have message here that it's from W. Jensen. Would you be willing to share your delegated design specification as an example?
Oh, my employer might not be too crazy about that, I'm sorry to say, but at the very least, you know, I've addressed in here the types of things that we've addressed in it, and that's probably about as far as I think I could go as a response to that. I understand the question, and I might have asked it myself if our roles were reversed, but I probably wouldn't be I might get in some hot water if I start sharing that openly.
Can I have a question? My name is Jennifer Sun. I'm with the architecture firm in Columbus, Ohio as well. Some of the things that were on your list of items that you would typically see is delegated design. We have had on projects as design assist. And in listening to your presentation, I was thinking that some of the differences, you know, might be like at what point in time in the design or the project process do you want to be reviewing that scope of work with Design Assist? We have the opportunity to be reviewing that coordination with the rest of the project earlier than you would as something with the contractor. Anything else that you kind of want to comment? Because some of the discussion certainly felt applicable to Design Assist.
I'm glad you brought that up because I have certainly encountered a difference of opinion on what terms apply to which. So at least in my opinion and in the delegated design guidelines that we've drafted for HDR engineering here, design assist refers to the architect or engineer engaging with a contractor or fabricator, whether or not that kind of engagement in the design phase might be a contractual relationship where they're actually the engineer or architect is actually paying money to the contractor or fabricator for their involvement, review, and feedback on portions of the design. But it's the fact is it's all taking place during the design phase, and that those the final input you get back from the entity that you're interacting with is incorporated into the final drawings and specs before you go out for bids or proposals. So that's how I view design assist and delegated design. Of course, as you define what are the performance and design criteria this sort of, if you will, mini design build in the project must satisfy, and you put it out for bids and the contractor, you know, their design professional designs it afterwards. So slight differences, but I've often encountered people who refer to delegated design and design assist as synonyms. And I guess, at least for me, I differentiate them that way.
It's gone on a little longer than I thought.
We have one from Robert Swan. Do you want to ask directly or do you want me to read it from the messages?
I guess it's basically, it's the question is typed out. It's can Kevin see it or can he read it? I don't think you need to read it out.
Well, okay. Kevin can't see the chat.
Oh, Kevin can't see the chat.
Yeah,
oh.
I've got a full screen of my slides.
Okay, all right. It's basically in your delegated design section, the general information in that section. I thought you said you repeated a lot of the same information that's in the general conditions of the contract.
No, if I did that, I might have said such a thing inadvertently.
Okay.
Certainly what I hoped I said and what I certainly intended is that you do not repeat what's in the general conditions.
Okay.
I said at one point, though, that I have in my firm's section 013573, a simple little paragraph that says something about, you know, the delegated design requirements of the general conditions apply, or some plain vanilla, very brief paragraph like that. And the reason why I have it there is not only to alert project teams to the fact that, hey, there's something in the general conditions you need to look at, since, you know, a lot of us specifiers will say nobody reads the general conditions, although of course that's somewhat true, but some people do read them. But the other thing is that there's plenty of project teams that work with a set of Division Zero documents or general conditions that are unique to a given client. And I've seen very few of those types of documents that address delegated design at all. So I was trying to write our section 013573 so that if you're trying to marry it to a client's unique general conditions that you could, and those client GCs do not address delegated design. Well, you could take that one paragraph out of our spec, delete it and replace it with the language you copied out of A201 if you're an architect, or EJCDC C700 if you're an engineer, to make sure that you get that essential provisions of the AIA or EJCDC general conditions into your construction contract when the owner's general conditions are not addressing delegated design at all.
Okay, thank you.
This is Deb Senior. I just, in case someone joined a little bit later, we had mentioned up front there was a lot of folks that joined without pre-registering, and we don't have your email information or AAA numbers in order to get the certificates to you. So if you could please email me at dsiener@foyt-albert.com, and I can get you on the list so we can make sure you get your certificates. Or if you need to, you could probably email it to the to our CSI website, and we can make sure we get you on that list.
Or at the very least, if you don't remember any of that, but you have my email address, it's on the screen here, you can also use that, and I'll just simply forward it to Deb.
Okay. And I caught everybody that had emailed me or had messaged me during the chats. They messaged me directly, and I captured all